Luke sitting in for Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. Dolphins, Douglas Adams writes in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series, are the second most intelligent species on Earth. Mice, of course, are the first. The British comic author imagines that mice in the lab experiments are learning more about human intelligence than vice versa. Our guests this hour are the cognitive scientists Mark Hauser and Elizabeth Spikey. They're puzzling out the same problem as Douglas Adams' mice. How do you measure an animal's intelligence without directly communicating with it? A century ago, Mark Hauser and Elizabeth Spielke would be in a whole different field of science. Hauser, who studies intelligence in monkeys, would be a behavioral zoologist. Spielke, who studies human infants, would be a psychologist. Modern science brings them together. It turns out that for all the difference in animal and human intelligence, the two are really a lot alike. The more scientists try to isolate what makes human intelligence special, the harder they find the task. We're talking about human minds and animal minds this hour on The Connection. How do you measure the intelligence of the animals around you, the cats, the dogs, the backyard birds? How do you measure the growing minds of infants? Can you see them mapping out their world from concrete to abstract? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK joins The Connection this hour. Mark Hauser is a professor at Harvard and the author of Wild Minds, What Animals Really Think. And Elizabeth Spielke is a professor at MIT. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start, if we can, with the connection of how knowledge is acquired. And it's kind of a broad question, but let's start there, Mark.
I guess the challenge for us as researchers working on animals is to make a distinction, I think, a little bit between what kinds of knowledge animals know about and are aware of, as opposed to the kind of information that just guides their behavior. Chomsky made a distinction, I think, years ago about universal grammar guiding the infant's production of speech without actually really knowing about the sort of the structure of that grammar. I think the same thing applies for a lot of the work that we do. There's much about the animal mind that we can infer from their behavior without actually knowing what they're actually specifically aware about.
For example?
For example, we see animals using tools in the wild. Chimpanzees, as Jane Goodall described, will take sticks and insert them into holes to pull out termites. The question there is simply, what do animals know about tools as opposed to the fact that they can actually use an object to come to some conclusion about getting termites? So I think the distinction there is really what they really know about the nature of tools as opposed to being able to use objects to gain access to food.
Elizabeth, how do you approach the question?
Well, I don't think there's a single question, how is knowledge acquired? Because I don't think knowledge is a single unitary thing. What we see when we look at infants, and I think what we also see in looking at adults and other animals, is a diverse set of systems of knowledge. Different ones have different properties. They get acquired in different ways. They grow in different ways at different times in children, and they're shared to different extents between humans and other animals. So we need to look system by system, but because humans are also very flexible and inventive kinds of creatures, we have to ask how we bring these different systems together and create whole new domains of knowledge and ways of thinking.
Well, what is it that that animals and babies seem to know at the same time when they're very little?
Well, we don't have complete answers to this because, of course, we haven't looked at everything. But we certainly find in looking at human infants and also, as Mark and others have done at other animals, rapidly growing systematic knowledge about objects, how things behave in the world, how they move, how they interact with each other. And we also see rapidly growing knowledge about people and human actions and what goals they're directed to and how they move around. There are other things that are less obvious on the surface, but that I think we can infer from studies of young developing children, 1.5, 2-year-olds, that there's growing knowledge about space. There's knowledge about abstract things like number coming together quite rapidly in young children.
Give me an example or two from experiments that you've done that will help demonstrate what you're talking about.
Well, I think the most famous example comes from work work that was originally conducted by Jean Piaget, asking about the basic knowledge that things exist independently of you and that they continue existing, whether you're in the room with them and looking at them and interacting with them or not.
And what was the experiment about?
Well, Piaget's experiments asked children to search for objects. He took objects that children were interested in and hid them under a pillow or behind a cover, and looked at the children's attempts to search for them, and found that children are quite bad at this until they're about a year and a half old. It's easy to get them to make very clear mistakes or simply to stop searching altogether. But an issue that Mark already made is this could be either because of limits on children's knowledge or because of limits on their ways of putting knowledge, expressing their knowledge in action, putting it to use in acting on the world. What's happened more recently is people have asked children the same questions. Does an object still exist when it's out of sight? But they've tested for it in ways that didn't require children to act in fancy ways. And when you do this, you find evidence that children are representing objects as continuing to exist when they're out of sight as early as 2 or 3 months of age for human infants. You also find evidence for this in both infant and adult animals of various sorts, including, I was somewhat horrified to see, in newborn chickens. Newly hatched chickens also seem to represent objects that are hidden behind screens. So this may be a representation.
How do they do? What kind of objects? Seed?
What they do with the chickens is rely on a phenomenon that Mark could tell you much more about than I can, of imprinting. If you take a chick and raise it in an environment where there's no mother around or other chicks around for it to relate to, but there's a single object that's present and that moves around, and you can make it really any kind of object, I think, such as a red ping pong ball in the study I'm thinking of, the chick will imprint to that object. And in the future, if given the chance, the chick will follow that object. Well, now you can do studies where you take the object, move it behind a screen, and ask the chick, in effect, is it still there, by seeing whether the chick will go, move around behind the screen
and
get to
it,
and they do.
And what's this tell you, Mark?
I think what this tells us, I agree with Liz on this one, is that there are at least three basic capacities that I think are shared universally across all animals, including humans, and we see it early in human infant development, and Liz really pointed them out, but it's the basic capacity to recognize objects and their behavior, to enumerate them, and to navigate in space. And I think the beauty of this kind of work, the comparative work, is that some of the same kinds of methods that have been used on human infants have now been able to be used on animals. And so, following up on what Liz said, we've begun to use a technique that the infancy researchers have used, and Liz in particular, which is basically a magic show. So you show one object disappearing behind a screen, followed by a second object disappearing behind the screen. And if the animal or human infant has really represented those two objects in its mind, then when you pull the screen, it should expect to see two things. If it now sees only one, or it sees three, a violation of the number of objects there, it should look longer. And that's a fact what you find with very young infants under the age of a year, and you also find this with adult primates. So this provides us with a way of asking non-linguistic creatures about how they represent objects, in this case, represent number.
How do we know? Well, of course you don't, but let me ask the question anyway. How do we know what's going on in that primate's head?
Well, I think what we know about how they represent things is by basically these creative kinds of experiments. So the way it's set up is something like this. When we see a magician sawing a body in half on a stage, and then the bodies are split apart and brought together again, the reason why we're surprised and look long is because we know that bodies can't be physically separated and brought together again without some pretty serious surgery. So what we set up are cases where we generate expectations about physical principles of the world and then use those as tools to ask about what the animal knows. If the animal has some expectation about the physical world, then it should detect a violation, and we pick up on that detection by how long it looks at something. So looking becomes a tool for understanding some aspects of knowing.
What else is in your toolkit, as you like to call it?
Well, what I claim is that there are these, I think, as I said before, three basic tools that I think are universal, and that's the capacity to recognize objects, count them, and navigate in space. And I think those are shared across all species. Then I think what we find is that you begin to look at the kinds of social and ecological pressures that animals confront in their world, and you begin to see specialized tools, the ability to learn from others, to imitate, the ability to attribute beliefs and desires to others. Those become specialized tools that are clearly not present in all species and reflect, I think, the particularities of the social and ecological environment.
Now, you're talking about, to go right to the pond, so to speak, you're talking about the ducklings following the mother and exhibiting the same sort of feeding behavior that the mother does.
Well, in the case of space, I think this is where some of Lispelke's work on children, as well as the work that's been done on many other animals, shows that one common mechanism for navigating in space is dead reckoning, where you basically use the distance and speed of movement as a way of calculating where you are and where you're going. And this has been elegantly shown in insects navigating through desert environments, hamsters navigating in a woods, ducklings moving around in space, and children. Moving around in an artificial environment in the laboratory. So I think what you find here is a common mechanism that really unites all species. You then can get elaborations on top of that. And so some of the work that Liz has done suggests that language may be one vehicle that allows humans to go beyond this kind of core basic mechanism for spatial navigation.
Now, before we get to the language question, Liz, do infants get that at about the same time?
Get what?
Get the navigational portion of where we are, the spatial aspect, get it at the same time as infant animals?
Navigation is unfortunately one area where we really can't ask that question, because human infants aren't moving around on their own. We are the slowest developing creature, I believe, for showing independent locomotion. It's only around 7 or 8 months that babies start crawling, and it's only around a year or beyond when they start walking. Now, even we as adults, when we're moved only passively through an environment, we tend not to keep track of where we are. If I'm driving a car to get from one place to another, I'll usually be able to get there again. But if I'm a passenger in the car, I may well lose track of where I'm going. A young baby is perpetually like a passenger in a car, being passively moved around. So we can't ask of the youngest babies, what are their capacities for representing the environment? But what we can do is look at kids at the age when they're first starting to actively explore environments on their own. And that's the point where you start seeing evidence for the same dead reckoning kinds of abilities and other navigational abilities in human children that you see in other animals.
All right, now let's get to the language question. Where does or how does language seem to fit in our development? Who wants to start with that? Liz?
Let's follow up.
I can start with that, because I think what Mark would say is it doesn't for any animals other than humans. I think this is a burning question today, and there's a lot of controversy in the field about how does language influence thought? Does it influence thought in any serious ways? Or does it only influence the way we communicate our thoughts? My own view, partly arising from studies where we've looked at things like navigation and number abilities in infants, and we find abilities in infants, but we also see qualitative differences in adults. I think language is making us more flexible, and I think it's allowing us to take diverse kinds of information and bring them together in new ways. One thing you find in other animals navigating around space is they're extremely good at getting around in the environment, often better than human adults are at keeping track of where they are and finding their way through the woods. For example, we might get more lost than other animals would, but they're not as flexible as we are. They don't make maps. They don't certainly don't communicate their knowledge. They don't use landmarks as flexibly as we do. And I think we start seeing that flexibility in children at about the time they start talking about space. That suggests there may be a connection there.
Now, when you're speaking about language on the human side, are you speaking strictly about the spoken word, or are you also speaking about the communication that we make with that babies make through gesture and other methods of communication?
I'm specifically talking about language, because the thing about gestural communication is, to some degree, I believe we do see aspects of that in other animals, but we don't see this kind of explosive flexibility in thinking in other animals that we see in humans. And one, there may be multiple reasons for that, but one, I think, may be that we have this quite special system of representation that natural languages gives us, and only gives us.
And you think that explosion occurs years, at about the time the words mom and dad start appearing, so to speak?
Well, that may be the first step. Language is growing in children, though, pretty continuously over a period of years, so I wouldn't expect a sudden leap from a purely animal state to a full-fledged human adult state, but rather a gradual change.
Mark, what's your take on this? First, and is there a language in animals, a voice that we're not recognizing?
Well, let's see. So let me answer your question first then. You know, over the past 50 or more years, there's been a very explicit interest in people working on animals to figure out the extent to which the natural communication of animals is either similar or dissimilar from the language of humans. And to some extent, people have found that certainly animals communicate with their own natural vocalization and exchange a lot of information about things going on in the environment. But when people have looked hard thus far, there seems to be two very striking differences between the natural communication of animals and the natural communication of humans in terms of language. One is that although animals have vocalizations which in some sense pick out or refer to objects and events in the environment like food and predators, it's very narrowly defined. They pick out a few things in the environment. They don't seem to be able to refer to things in the past or in the distant future or to create new sounds to talk about new novel things that happen to come into their environment. The second thing, which is critical, is that animals do not seem to be able to take those vocalizations and recombine them to create new kinds of expressions in the way that we can take words and recombine them into this infinite, powerful expressive system. So when you look at the natural communication, there really is a completely different thing going on. Now, what some would argue is that if you look at what can be taught to great apes like chimpanzees and orangutans and gorillas, the famous Coco and Washoe and Khonsi, that there you see maybe the glimmer of hope that there's at least a brain that has the potential to acquire a system like ours. But of course, that's still very controversial. So in terms of a language, I think it's a mistake to call the natural communication of animals a language, because in terms of at least two important properties of our natural language, reference and syntax, there seems to be no evidence.
But don't you think that there might be something that we're missing? That in the song of the bluebird or the cry of the wolf, we're not getting something?
I think as scientists, we always have to be open to that. I think in one sense, what I would say is that our tools for asking these questions are very much impoverished. We have very limited experimental methods to ask about the specific nature of the communication. I had a when I was working with vervet monkeys in East Africa, my thesis work was on their communication. I had a dream that I ran into one of the monkeys in the groups, and he was carrying around a little book, and the book said the book of vervet monkey translations. And I said, you know, can I take a look at that? He said, no, this is just for vervets. And I thought, you know, here's my thesis, it's all there. But you know, that's the hope, is that we're going to be able to crack this code and do some of the necessary translations. But right now, what's been done, there's been a huge amount of work in this area. It's not as if it's not a topic that hasn't been looked at. I'd say there's been at least 10, 15 years of careful looking, and nothing yet really jumps out as being like human language. That's not to say that we might not find it, but so far, we really don't have the kind of evidence you'd want.
What kind of experiments are you talking about that you use to try and bring you new knowledge along these lines, these experiments that some of which have failed to get at the questions that you're hoping to get answers to?
Well, the common experiments that we do with the natural vocalizations of animals is that in nature, we start off by observing what the animals do and look at the correspondence between the vocalizations they emit and the context in which they emit them. And one of the classic examples in this area comes from a study that was done in the 60s by Thomas Strusaker, where he observed that vervet monkeys, an oral monkey living in Africa, when they see different predators, they produce different sounding alarm calls. So one call for a leopard, one call for an eagle, one call for a snake. Many years later, the ethologists Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfarth and Peter Marler took that problem and took it to the next level. They said the following: if those sounds truly refer to those predators, like our words, leopard, eagle, and snake, then if I record those vocalizations and play them back through a loudspeaker, the animal should respond as if the predator was there. And in fact, that's precisely what they found. If you play back a leopard alarm call, the animals respond by scanning the horizon and then running up into trees. If they hear an eagle alarm call, they look up in the sky and then head under a bush, which is the safest place to be for an eagle. If they hear a snake alarm call, they stand bipedally and scan the ground around them. What these studies show is that the sound alone is sufficient to elicit an appropriate response in the animal, suggesting that when the animal hears this call, they in some sense represent something like an eagle or a snake. But there are alternative interpretations for that, like it's simply a command. Get up into a tree, go under a bush, stand bipedally. So even if the interpretation is that those sounds mean leopard, eagle, and snake, it's very confined. If I know the context in which the animal is confronted something, I can predict with absolute certainty what they're going to say. That is not true about anything having to do with human language.
Mm-hmm. And one wonders what would happen if the call for a leopard was sounded but a snake appeared.
Well, there are some nice anecdotal stories from vertebrate world where, in fact, one of my own observations, an adult male was trying to mate with a female, and the female refused, and he tried all day long, and eventually he got annoyed and slapped the female in the head. She screamed, and now she and all of her relatives chase the male around the entire territory. He then sits down and gives a leopard alarm call. They all go up into a tree while he sits down on the ground, no leopard to be seen. So there are these kind of cute stories of animals using calls which seem deceptive in one sense, because clearly in this case there was no leopard to be seen.
Well, it's the survival instinct, though, isn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, where do you see the link, if you see the link, between the minds of animals and the minds of infants? Join the conversation with Mark Hauser and Elizabeth Spelke. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Elizabeth, how does language change our thought, do you think?
I think language probably changes our thought in multiple ways. First of all, it gives us a way of acquiring new knowledge extremely rapidly when we can communicate with other people through language. As Mark was saying, we can talk not only about the here and now, learning about the things that we're directly observing, but we can extend the range of things that we can learn about to things that happened in the past, things that could happen hypothetically, and so forth. So as a medium of communication, it provides a powerful tool for increasing knowledge.
And how would we see that demonstrated in an infant?
You wouldn't see that demonstrated in an infant. When infants and other people, if you look at the earliest conversations, they actually do tend to be about the here and now. And that makes sense if you think about the task that the child has. Of course, individual specific natural languages are learned, and they differ from one speech community to another. So the child's first task is to figure out what other people are talking about. And to do that, other people better be talking about things that are happening around the child so that the child can relate what she's seeing to what other people are saying. So the earliest conversations aren't about Christopher Columbus discovering America or things that might have hypothetically happen in the future. So I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, let's bring some connection listeners into the conversation. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Jeff from Boston, you're on the connection. Hi there.
Is this me?
Yes. Oh, okay. We're pretty sure it's you.
I'm John, not Jeff. At any rate, I would think that an important indicator in the intelligence of an animal or even a child is a developmental stage is the ability to lie or manipulate your reality in some way. Because that implies a great deal, I would think. And I certainly have had pets, especially dogs, who would attempt to do this.
Give us an example.
Well, I had a dog who had a light-colored fur, and he was repeatedly admonished for going on this couch. And we never saw him on the couch, but nonetheless, we continued to find his fur on it. And we were scratching our heads. We never see him. And every night when we go to bed, he'd take his place at the foot of the bed, and you wake up in the morning, and he'd be at the foot of the bed still. Except one night, we heard a loud thump. And we turn the light on, and he comes slinking back to the bedroom What had happened was he rolled off the couch in his sleep and fell onto the floor. So he would wait until we fell asleep, go to the couch, wait until we, before we got up and retake his place at the foot of the bed. In a deliberate attempt to deceive us.
Yeah, either that or maybe you just kicked too much in the bed after you went to sleep.
No. He made a deliberate attempt to deceive us into thinking he had never moved.
Mark Hauser.
These are very nice observations. I think they're the kinds of things that I think all of us who work on animals use as our insights to take the problem further. And I think, you know, this is the kind of thing that I would challenge you to go back with your dog and sort of check out. So, for example, what has the dog actually figured out about this problem? Has he simply figured out that when you're in one room, i.e. your bedroom, it can get away with sleeping on the couch, and when you're anywhere else, it shouldn't try that? So one thing to play around with is that there have been a set of studies with animals, in particular chimpanzees, showing that although they can follow the direction of eye gaze of where someone's looking, they don't seem to know that where someone is looking tells them about what that person knows. So, for example, if you're in your bedroom looking out onto the couch, but you're still in the bedroom, will they still do the same thing? Do they attend to where you're looking? Do they understand that where you're looking is what you know? And I think that's the kind of experiment you want to get at with your pets, because animals are very good at picking up on associations that if you're in a certain place, then they can do the following. That doesn't tell us that they lie or deceive with an intent to do so. And I think that's the critical distinction.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. At what point, well, we should probably approach this after the break, but I want to ask you, Liz, at what point does deception and lying show itself in babies when they first start interacting with their moms and their dads?
Sure. As Mark was saying, for other animals, when you see a young child do something deceptively, you have to ask, are they doing that because they conceive of the people that they're interacting with as having minds and having beliefs, and they want to influence, manipulate their beliefs, give them a false belief? Or have they learned something more superficial? I'm being told to stop.
Yeah, we'll get at that question after the break. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com.
From Boston.
This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in today for Chris Lydon. We're talking this hour about the development of intelligence in humans and animals, what's common and what's uncommon about what they learn and when they learn it. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. In the studio with us, our guest, Mark Hauser, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Harvard, and Liz Spelke, professor of brain and cognitive sciences at MIT. And before the break, Liz, we were talking about deception and the development of deception in infants.
What we think of as deception in adults relies crucially on a notion that people have beliefs and that those beliefs can be false. That seems to be something that isn't there in very young children. It's around age 4 or so that children first show very clearly in both their own actions and in the judgments they make about other people and what other people are going to do, that they understand that people's actions are guided by their beliefs and those beliefs can be false. That's not something we see in very young infants.
But play can be deceptive.
Play can be deceptive, but play... The question is, do you need to know that you are deceiving someone and that they have beliefs that are guiding their actions in order to play? Probably not. We see play in lots of animals. We see play in very young children. But in situations where tasks are set up, where you'll only be able to make sense of what somebody's doing by understanding their beliefs, and their beliefs can depart from reality, they can be false. In those situations, young children, and in most cases other animals, are telling us they're not thinking about things that way.
Can you agree with that?
Yeah, I would just add to that. I think that one interesting transitional point is between play and pretense. And pretense comes in quite a bit earlier than the kinds of deception that Liz was talking about in terms of having a theory about somebody else's beliefs and desires. And what's intriguing is that there's been not so much evidence of pretense in animals, except for you find peculiar cases of, you know, dogs chasing imaginary things. And there's a wonderful case from a colleague of mine, Richard Wrangham at Harvard, who describes a young juvenile chimpanzee in Kibale whose mother had just given birth. And the juvenile had a log that she carried around and cradled as if it was a small child. And but these are sort of isolated cases, but I think there's an interesting part to pretense, because it's really sort of imagining an imaginary world. And in one sense, to do deception, you have to kind of model a possible world and sort of act on it. So pretense is an interesting transitional point, that animals may have pretense but may not take the next step, which is to sort of think about others' thoughts and desires.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Jack, you're on The Connection. Hi there.
Hi. I was wondering, as a general question, whether they, you know, since we and animals are supposed to be on the longest continuum of evolution, whatever, whether there's anything they've learned from the animals back about us. And a specific question I have is, you had Steve Pinker on a while ago, and he referred to language as being actually wired into our brains as a unique kind of thing for we as animals. And I found it hard to understand, because I didn't understand at what point the structure would get wired into us and not exist in other animals. So I'll ask about that as also something where they've thought about that in animals.
Liz Belke?
Well, it's mostly a question about animals, so I should deflect it over to Mark. But just let me say that we know that there's all kinds of unique things about us. We walk on two legs, we build tools, we do lots of things. I think we shouldn't exclude the possibility that the language faculty is a unique thing about us.
Mark Hunter.
Yeah, I think the question about our uniqueness is something that unfortunately gets in the way of kind of the serious sort of work we have ahead. And it's that what I like to think of better is that all animals have their unique capacities and adaptations, and it's because of the particular environments in which they evolve. So it really makes no sense to ask questions about a hierarchy of intelligence and we're really unique and nobody else is unique. I mean, all species have their unique capacities. The real task for all of us is to figure out which ones are and how do they evolve and why do they evolve in that particular way. When you get to the kinds of views that Steve Pinker has articulated in The Language Instinct and How the Mind Works, I think what he's capitalizing on is what we talked about in the first half hour, which is that what seems to be special about language, if you look at our language as opposed to the natural communication of animals, is that animals don't seem to have the communicative power of our words, and certainly don't have the power to recombine those words into this infinite capacity that we have. It's at that level that I think Steve wants to talk about a really unique adaptation that evolved somewhere within the hominid line, somewhere, you know, within the last 5 to 6 million years. Something really changed. Now, the work ahead is going to be at the neurobiological level to figure out which particular structures are special in humans that animals lack. And I think now with the capacity for modern neuroimaging techniques that allow us to compare the human brain in action with animal brains in action, we're going to be able to figure out where those differences lie.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Bob, you're on The Connection. Thanks, Jack, for your call. Bob, you're on now.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
Mark, I tried to track you down because I think this show was played before, maybe a month or two ago. And at that point, some lady called in and talked about a boy that was evidently raised with apes and, you know, discovered a Tarzan kind of syndrome. And it sounded to me like she was a little bit dismissed. But I do remember that on the BBC, they did that interview just a week before that last show, where that youth was able to speak, of course, in English, but was also able to communicate with apes. How valuable would that kind of a situation be in your testing?
Well, I don't think I dismissed that case. I said that the cases that have been described in the past about, you know, wild children reared by animals, what has happened since then in terms of the capacities of those children to develop language and communicate, that's what's been debatable. When one says that humans can communicate with animals, I think the real trick is that can they produce sounds which have the same kind of communicative function as the animals do? I mean, I can make some of the sounds that my animals make. That's different from having them respond to me in that particular way. Okay. So I think the value would potentially come in if there's some way that children reared in an environment which was with animals and with humans, somehow that gave us insights in terms of the flexibility of the human brain to acquire different communicative systems. So Sue Savage-Rumbaugh and her work with Kanzi, they have studies where children were reared in the same kind of environment as the apes were reared, but those children were never able to communicate with the chimps using their particular vocal communication system. So I think the potential value of it is in learning about the flexibility of the human brain to acquire different communicative systems.
Elizabeth, how does environment factor in the development of human intelligence?
Well, that's
another big question.
certainly, much of what's special about human intelligence are the way we build these huge systems of knowledge is learned. I mean, babies aren't born knowing about baseball or cooking or formal science or any number of other domains. So learning and knowledge acquisition, both informal acquisition and also explicit teaching, are obviously extremely important in human development. I think, though, that one of the real big messages from recent work is that learning isn't knowledge isn't written on the child like on a blank slate. Learning builds on systems of knowledge that we already have and allows us to carry them further and extend them into new territory. But those systems are already present, and the children are using them in learning all the time.
Talk about the first 3 years.
The first 3 years of life, well, this is a time that I'm particularly interested in. Most of my work is on children at that age. Obviously, children of that age are not yet involved in formal, explicit instruction of any kind, but they're learning an enormous amount. They're starting to learn language, and that's a huge learning task, even if you believe, as Noam Chomsky and Steve Pinker and many others do, that the language faculty is part of human's innate endowment. Nevertheless, specific languages are learned, and children have to be acquiring vocabulary at a very rapid rate and also learning about the specific rules of their language. They also have to be learning to recognize objects, to categorize things, to figure out who their relatives are and who their friends are and how their house is laid out. It's a time of enormous learning, which makes it a very fascinating time to study, to try to figure out how they're solving all these tasks.
Yeah, can I ask you a question about how their survival instinct factors in here? I've always wondered if one of the reasons babies are freed to learn about so many other things is that at some point in their development they realize they've got this survival thing whipped, that they're all right, and that the portion of their brains that is dedicated to making sure they're going to be okay, that they're going to survive, is now freed up to think about other new and wondrous things in front of them, and that portion of the brain in the animal is never really freed up.
Is that one for me?
Whoever wants to take
it. I would actually, I guess, say that I don't think that any animal, humans included, are ever freed from the burden of survival, that there is always a great risk of being a human, that parents can abandon you, parents may not take care of you in the way, there's an external threat, you leave the home environment and you've got an external threat. I don't think humans are freed from that. I think it's been, in fact, a common mistake to think that somehow we've escaped some of the key evolutionary pressures. And I think one of the great services that some of Steve Pinker's popular writings have done is to make it clear that the evolutionary pressures on humans are as great and as important as they are on other animals. So I guess I wouldn't argue that humans are freed up from survival instinct, that it's always there. It always guides at some level their behavior to survive, to find relevant mates and so forth, that our minds are created in the same way that animals are in that sense.
Ms. Belke?
Well, I'll disagree with you a little there, Mark. It does seem one thing that's really distinctive about us is how long childhood lasts. even though this varies to some degree from one culture to another, nevertheless, it's the case that children are relatively protected from the demands of finding their own food, protecting themselves from predators and so forth by the older people in their families and in their community. And this, I think, does free children to explore, to play, to learn. Though, again, you look at other animals, and they're doing a lot of those things, too.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones. Patrick, you're on The Connection. Thanks for calling.
Oh, yes, thank you for letting me on the show. I grew up in Africa, and we used to have gardens that were bordering, like, forests, and we used to have monkeys and other primates. But one thing that I noticed growing up is sometimes these animals would invade our gardens and destroy the vegetables and all that was in the garden. But whenever they used to send us as kids to chase them away, whenever they would come in to the gardens, they would always refuse to go. They would always refuse when you have children chasing them or women. And it's only when you had males that would chase these monkeys away. So my question would raise is, how would they know who would harm them and who would not? And I'll take my question off there.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. Mark?
That's a great observation, mostly because I've had exactly the same experience in a campsite that I lived in Kenya, where the vervet monkeys would come into our kitchen and raid it. And if any man walked anywhere near the kitchen, they would flee. And if any woman walked near the kitchen, they would just sit there and eat to their heart's content. And I had a very close friend who was quite a bit larger than I was, quite a bit more muscular than I was, and she would do it, and they would still stay in the kitchen. So it was definitely a gender effect. And, you know, who knows? I mean, the way women walk versus the way men walks, odors. I assume it could be a whole variety of cues, but I don't really have a good answer for your question, except for the fact that I absolutely agree. And I think every field researcher who's ever worked on primates has had exactly the same experience as yours.
Liz Belke, at what point this raises another question for infants. At what point do we see the a stronger connection to the mom developing in most babies as opposed to the connection to dad?
I think this varies a lot across families. This was actually the problem that I did my first research on as an undergraduate, these many years ago. What you find is in families where both parents are actively involved in caring for children, they develop close emotional relationships with both parents pretty much indistinguishably, I believe. In situations where fathers are less involved, or I would imagine if you had the reverse situation as well, if you get to very, very extreme differences, then you'll start to see preferential orienting towards the parent who's a constant part of the child's environment.
What role does instinct play in infants in this regard?
Instinctive, I don't think that instincts like knowledge, I don't think it's a single thing, but I think we have a number of built-in predispositions that you can call instincts, if you like, that will tend to get the baby very, very early on oriented to the other people around her. A predisposition to pay attention to other faces, to look at faces, to follow people as they move, to quiet to voices, to pick out speech in their own language or speech by people who are familiar to them and pay special attention to that. There's, I think, a lot of different mechanisms that orient the child to other people right away.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. To the phones again. Leslie, you're on The Connection. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I have a similar comment to the last caller. I was wondering how you would categorize what I was told that lions can scent a Maasai warrior in Africa, and they will stay away because of the history of the Maasai killing lions, where now they no longer allowed to. Just curious how that gets passed on from generation to generation of lions when the killing no longer continues, yet they still stay away.
Well, Although it's against the rules in many parks for lions not to be killed by the Maasai warriors. Of course, outside the park areas, Maasai still do hunt lions, not for food, but as a kind of rite of passage that the young warriors must go through. So hunting of lions by Maasai is still going on. How they learn about it, as you may know, lions live in prides, and the young are with the mothers, the females, when they go on hunts, and presumably one of the mechanisms by which the young might learn and therefore that information passed on is through observation. So in the area that I was working in Kenya, you're absolutely right. The lions are quite fearful of the Maasai, not so much, unfortunately for us, for other researchers who are not Maasai. And I presume they pick up on both the distinctive coloration of the Maasai's wardrobe, these red cloaks, which are very vivid, their spears, the fact that the Maasai move with cattle, as well as some of the very distinctive smells they have when they sort of paint themselves with ochre and so forth. So there are a number of cues, visual, auditory, and smell that people, that the lions could be using to pick up on the presence of the Maasai and presumably pass it down from generation.
Leslie, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Joel, you're on the connection now. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Relative to what you're just speaking about, it's always amazing to me when animals are aware that they are safe because they are in a particular location, elsewhere they will be extremely cautious and give themselves a lot of leeway. Also, relative to what was said earlier about people being relieved of their survival chores as manifest by their long childhood. Elephants have childhood going as long as human beings, so I don't think the analogy applies since they don't develop a language that we perceive, even though they do seem to have a fantastic oral language, long distance, in fact, of their own. What I wanted to mention is that I recall hearing theories that human babies do not learn their languages from their environment, from their elders, that they instinctively pick up on tones of voice, like the baby talk a bit, and this seems to apply to animals as well. That does seem to be a cross-species innate hardwired instinct, a gruff, rough, low, loud tone is something to be wary of. A high, squeaky baby talk tone is not to be worried about. But that they have found that deaf children, unaware of spoken languages or unable to appreciate them or study them or anything, amongst themselves develop their own language, complete with vocabulary, syntax, rules of grammar, everything else, albeit different from those of the spoken language. And they develop language at the same, roughly the same rate, at the same ages, amongst themselves, their own unique language, and they learn it from each other. The young one learns it from those that already know it, but it seems like the babies learn it by seeing what works. In other words, they're picking up on what their environment feeds back to them from actions that they themselves take, rather than just being observant and absorbing.
All right,
I'm
Joel.
Curious on your comments.
All right, Joel, let's hear Liz Pelkey on that.
Well, I think you've made a number of really good points, Joel. So to start with, certainly having a long period of immaturity is not sufficient to develop a language or learn anything else. It may just be one of the many different conditions that fosters that process in us. Second, if humans are the only creatures with the capacity to learn a natural language, then there must be an awful lot about us already before children start the task of learning a language that makes that learning possible. And you've pointed to a number of these things. So yes, children are oriented to the speech of other people. They're very sensitive to intonation. There's been a lot of beautiful work recently showing they're sensitive to information that it's eventually going to tell them where words begin and end, where phrases begin and end. They need to be able to use all these kinds of sensitivity in order to break into this puzzle of language learning. But for all of that, it nevertheless remains true that different languages of the world are different. They have different vocabularies, they have different syntactic rules, and they do need to be learned.
Mark, is language overrated?
I don't think language is overrated. I think the complexity comes in figuring out exactly what language is doing to alter thoughts in humans, young humans, older humans. I think the point that was just raised, however, is a very interesting one in terms of thinking about language, because if we think about things like the tone of our voice, this is something that we do actually share with animals, and that's a common ground for us and the animals, and something that has a very deep and old evolutionary past.
Mark Hauser, Elizabeth Spelke, thanks very much for exploring the topic this hour with us on The Connection.
Thank you.
Mark Hauser is professor of psychology and neuroscience at Harvard and author of Wild Minds, What Animals Really Think. Liz Spelke is professor of brain and cognitive sciences at MIT. I'm Bob Oakes, in today for Chris Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
For The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation. PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Barnes & Noble at Boston University, where Dr. Jeffrey Dreher will discuss and sign his book, The Cost-Effective Use of Leeches and Other Musings of a Medical School Survivor, Tuesday, March 21st at 7 p.m.